Happy special legislative session week. Thanks for being with us. I am Heidi Hatch with KUTV 2 News, Mara Carabello from the Axoro Group, and Greg Hughes, who is now a former Speaker of the House, a citizen, and also a lobbyist.
Yeah, sitting in the cheap seats out here now.
Sitting in the cheap seats, just with the rest of us.
So thanks for being with us. I love that it's sunny outside today. Time is flying by, and this legislative session, I think they actually blanked out, we talked about last week, for two full weeks. So I'm very pleased that it only took a couple days. Did either of you drop in at the sessions, or did you just watch from afar?
I watched from afar. I don't generally go up unless I need to, and I wasn't needed.
So I may lobby, but I lobby on the side of angels. So I lobby for the sheriffs and for our association of counties and even for Washington County.
Bail reform was on the list.
Bail reform was a big one. So I had a number of issues we've been working on because we love public safety in the state of Utah. It's kind of our thing. We like public safety. And so there was a bill that was a catch and release, cashless bail nightmare that was having all kinds of problems. And so we repealed it, but we went into this working group and spent 8 months with what we call in public policy stakeholders. And those would be prosecutors and defense attorneys and the sheriffs and those that are involved in the criminal justice system. And we came up with a bill that was passed yesterday that was a product of 8 months of working together.
Carried by one of our fine Democratic legislators.
Yes, that was one of the negotiating points as well. And so, yes, that bill was sponsored by Representative Pitcher from the Minority Caucus in the House. And it's so funny that issue's had so much, I don't know, there's just been a lot of controversy around it.
But is it done? Are you guys coming back for the session? Or
no,
did you
I think
cover
it's
everything?
Pretty much done. I think we're going to see, so bail is back. Everybody want to...
So are you pleased with the result, or are you garbage,
look,
let's go back?
This whole cashless bail catch and release is just not working well. Public safety is being harmed everywhere, and so you see this cashless bail in states like New York and more blue states. Somehow it passed into law in Utah. We'll have a bail schedule back, and that will give this middle ground where you don't hold people too long, because you don't want to pinky swear and release them. But for those that can make bail, they will, and then they'll have a magistrate review that if they're too poor to pay or if the risk assessment is given, the magistrate or the judge will assign an appropriate bail or other condition, pretrial release conditions if their county provides.
This was a
very
nice,
wonkish.
This was
way.
A good,
wonkish.
I was just going to say that, good tough issue, because the advocates on slightly different sides, and I would say that the advocacy groups and this one were in a round table, not a square table, like they sort of circular a little.
I love to see that.
And they were all really wonky and sort of very qualified and coming from different points of view. So it really was, I think, a hard-fought compromise.
It was 8 months, and it was actually really painful because of the number of stakeholders we had around the table. So the competing opinions were just limitless. And so it took a long, long time to get there. But the funny part is, once you do something like that, if you do all that hard work up front, there's no debate. There's the committee hearing was nothing. The floor debate was nothing because everybody had.
Sounds a lot like redistricting.
I was going to say that.
Except for
the same comparison to the hardy 10 minutes y'all gave
redistricting. All the advocacy was, all the people were saying this is our bill. So you didn't really have a competing side saying no to the bill.
I just don't think that's the criteria of floor debate. But
well, look,
I hear
they
you.
Couldn't find anything they hated about it. Because it was satisfying. Look, what we did is we just said perfect can't be the enemy of good. There's plenty to hate about the bill from all sides. But if you're looking for common ground, then this was it. So it was good. It was good in that way.
Okay, I appreciate that. So is this the only bipartisan thing that came out of the legislative special session, are we thinking?
The redistricting maps were bipartisan. In
you're
a
so funny sometimes.
Sometimes
you are hilarious.
No, that wasn't that. But you know what? That's a lot of studio wrestling, I'll tell you right now. Everybody getting mad. I'm telling you, Hulk Hogan, Macho Man, all those guys don't have it on those lawmakers coming out of there yelling and screaming and everybody acting like it's a big deal. This is what redistricting looks like every 10 years. Everyone's like, oh, this is so terrible.
Greg
it's what
is
you
explaining
do.
How
it's
the supermajority rolls people every 10
no,
years. And they're
not.
Like, why do you
no,
all complain like, about
the
it?
Democrat districts
We're in charge.
Become, the Democrat districts are Democrat and the Republican districts are Republican. And there's just four seats in Congress. You cannot You would have to gerrymander the daylights out of finding in a statewide elections in Utah, the Republican won 75% of the vote. How in the world are you going to get a Democrat congressional district unless you gerrymandered it to death to have one
so
Democrat district?
I do want to talk about that. Let's let Mara have a say on this for a second. So Mara,
no, I'm actually just giving this. I'm not even expressing an opinion. I'm just laying down facts.
You're just laying down facts.
This is just premise.
Thank you.
I do think that this does happen across the country, so I think we should recognize that. I think people were hoping for something different. I know that there was hope that Spencer Cox, their governor, would come in after saying that he would be the governor of all people, that he would, you know, say, I'll veto this. We'll get to that in just a second. But the 4th Congressional District, when it was passed 10 years ago, people were saying there's no way that a Democrat can ever win. We've had two Democrats there. Has it drastically changed this time, Mara, where a Democrat can't win, or are we in the same boat we were or have been the last 10 years?
Well, I mean, the same applied. So to your point, the same intellect applied, which was you were trying to master at a congressional level the least likely path for a Democrat. And you had to do it in this instance by cutting up a county four ways. Now, what's interesting is the justification of that is, well, you can't do anything without cutting a county. That may be true. Cutting a county at four ways at an intersection seems a little surgical. So I think to your point, I think the tide that I would say would be Utah isn't a fixed red state. And so that you're seeing more and more of an attempt, and you saw this in sort of the rhetoric of urban versus rural, and you heard this a lot even about the districting committee. I heard over and over, well, X many counties never voted for it, and it was only the Wasatch Front. Well, yeah, population bases matter when you cut up things. Density matters. That's what representation is about. And so I want to, though, get philosophical about two or three things, and mostly just to change so that we don't have the same conversation that I've heard all week. Some interesting things that I've been thinking about is, one, it was really interesting to me that it appeared that the majority didn't really even attempt to significantly take in the public redistricting thing. Now, I'm not criticizing that. I'm play calling here.
Like, there could have been some more dog and pony show just
and
for
so
show.
And you have to ask yourself why. And it's an interesting conundrum that I will own that I've been on both sides of. And one is, gosh, where is our majority leaders that they are just like, I don't even want a dog and pony, right? It felt like sort of lip service. Now, one may be, I think it would be fair for them to say, gosh, whether I give you a week or 6 months, you're just going to come and yell at me either way, right? Like,
That were criticizing the maps before they were even drawn.
I mean, right.
The House chair for the redistricting was being criticized, and he hadn't even come up with an A map yet. So.
Yeah, and then conversely, you see leadership not even attempting to go through much gyration of accepting. So that's on both sides about
a lot of hearings, though, statewide, a lot of hearings.
By the redistricting committee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was categorically ignored from many points.
From Prop 4.
I'm just saying, it's interesting that leadership didn't even really pretend to thoughtfully consider. I'm not actually criticizing that position. I'm saying they didn't put any political energy into it.
They were honest about their...
Yeah, and that Spencer Cox sort of very quickly was like, don't look at me, man. I am not vetoing. And so he went down really quick in saying, no, I'm just going to let this happen. And so the question is the public being smart, or are advocates being smart and productive about being effective? And are legislators listening?
Can I ask a question instead of making it as a point? I have a sincere question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that the resignation of former Congressman Rob Bishop late in the process and walking away from that
soured things?
Undermined the credibility of the commission that he resigned late in the process. Did that signal to some that this was not as fair as advertised?
I believe that the rationale for doing it was political. And so,
you're cynical about the Congressman Bishop's resignation?
I'm not cynical. I am knowledgeable about how adroit former Representative Bishop is on politics. And so I saw that as a total political signal, and I actually saw both sides rally around it, right? One said, see, this is proof, and the other said, see, this is proof. So I do think it started the political finery.
You know, I will say this, that this whole narrative of we need to be above politics. Everybody has an opinion. Everybody has a take. Anybody telling you that they don't have, that they have a blank slate in their head, they don't have a single political preference either way, they're here to be above politics, I don't think it's true.
All because of the way we're born and raised. We have a bias inside
of us. Of course. Yeah. We're all wired this way. We have to at least acknowledge it. And the best you can do is say that you're going to take competing perspectives so that you can have that debate or that dialogue to try and get to, like we just spoke about, the bail reform, right? But anybody telling me they're above politics and they're going to draw a map that doesn't have any politics in it, that's just false advertising, and it's not real. And it makes you sound like you're high-minded and you're better than everybody else, but it's not real. And that's where I get to the pageantry of redistricting. There's a lot of this that's being discussed about it being unfair, and it's this and it's that. It happens every 10 years, and all you have to do is go to a state where the people that elect a majority of whatever party that is in the majority, how they draw those maps, the party that's in the minority who did not gain the confidence of the electorate enough to be the majority, doesn't like it. And it's not reserved for one party or the other. In Illinois, they drew
Is that a good excuse? Everybody does it, though.
But how do you get around it? How do you get around the inherent beliefs we have and opinions that we have? So if someone says to you, I think because we only have 4 members of Congress, we're not like these larger states that have dozens of members of Congress, we think that every member of Congress, there being only 4, mm-hmm. ought to have an urban, suburban, and rural constituency so that all those demographics will be heard or have a perspective where that their member of Congress will answer to their unique concerns. Our state, 80% lives along the Wasatch Front. To say if you want to include rural, that you're going to have to divide out and get rural components in each of those congressional districts, I can argue that that's not a stone-cold Republican perspective. I think it's a straight-faced, legitimate perspective that each member of Congress, being there only 4, ought to have rural in their district, because that's a area that's easy to forget when the numbers aren't as high to have their own congressional seat. So, you know, it's stuff like that. Those conversations actually take place when they're looking to draw these maps. And the staff that puts it together, so that the listeners know, they're nonpartisan, and they truly are. You can ask any member of the legislature, Republican or Democrat, and they will tell you that the staff calls balls and strikes. They are not putting their thumb on the scale for the majority party or the minority party, and those political considerations are not part of the formal map drawing process.
So,
they really aren't.
So a couple. One is, I do think it's really hard to draw state house maps because mm-hmm. you're down to such a level. I think to draw 4 quadrants on a congressional district isn't as hard as they made it. And I don't think anyone could defend the position of dividing Mill Creek by 4 was like your only option. That was just stupid. And shame on them.
Out of Mill Creek. That's a big problem. The guy doesn't even live in his district.
Well, we don't even care about
Ben McAdams didn't live in his district either.
And Mill Creek ends up getting looked at because the guy doesn't move into the district he won. It's his fault.
Give him his own. But I'm just saying that was an unforced error on the Republican side because it's just so easy to look at it and mm-hmm. criticize it. But that aside, one thing I'll criticize, and then I want to go back to Heidi's original question. It offends me somehow that when you use your political muscle and then your vernacular about it is public policy. I'm like, just muscle it up, man. Like, you're in.
I thought I owned that.
No, you did. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the people in office.
Okay.
And when they do this, we thoughtfully considered, and I'm like, that offends me. Just tell me you're in charge. I'm not. Like, I can live with that.
I'm the parent.
Don't have any humor.
I said at bedtime.
You don't want to be arrogant about it.
Well, you are arrogant by patting me on the head and telling me that that's the only way you can divide Mill Creek. So the other thing
I wouldn't have done that, by the way. I would not have drawn him into a district he didn't bother to move in. That's just me.
I want to.
If I were still there.
Hope to those people who want balance in Utah, in starting where Heidi did, which is, will this adequately live for 10 years to keep out Democrats, right? And I would just say one thing that's very interesting, a little Venn diagram here. Forever and ever, we're all now saying we're going to double by 2050, we're going to double to by 2060. So let's talk for a minute where the doubling is happening. So right now, Salt Lake County, much to the chagrin of my friends on the right, is predominantly reliably centrist to left of center. And that's Salt Lake County. But here's the bad news for the Republicans. Salt Lake County is not where the growth is going to happen.
Because Utah County is
going to
change,
out
I think.
Already,
yeah.
Right? So Davis County is going to grow like crazy. Twilla County is going to grow like crazy. Mm. And Utah, South Utah County, not the Point of the Mountain, mm. not Thanksgiving Point, not Draper, which I know is in Salt Lake, but that's not where it's going to grow. Welcome to Salem. Welcome to Payson. Welcome to Santaquin. That's where the growth is going to happen. Side and go into Nephi and Mona. So what
is the state
interesting
needs to do? I mean,
yeah,
it's pretty crowded up here in Salt Lake.
In the
yeah.
next 10 years, that's where the growth is going. So just take a minute to think about Greg's district in Draper, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And Draper Harriman where it is now.
It was an agricultural district.
Think about Daybreak. That was open property. Now Daybreak is one of the most highly producing voting districts in the state of Utah. And it's a rather moderate centrist district. It's an unreliable district for both parties, which I think is a golden district. But I'm just saying, I don't know that we know how this at the end
it could
of
drastically
years,
change. It's yes. True. I look back to being in fourth grade and my parents moved us from Kearns to West Jordan, and I remember just crying because we were moving to the farm in the middle of nowhere. And you look now and you're like, West Jordan, you know?
Right, I mean, middle, yeah.
Yeah. And now people are living like with homes overlooking the prison, you know, in Draper, you know? It's just like.
In 2002, Draper, my district was very conservative. It's a pink district now.
Sure.
It is not the conservative district it was when I was first elected.
When you redistricted Susanna Harrison out this last year.
So I have a couple more questions.
Out, she's drawn into
she's
that
drawn in.
That's what we call drawn out.
No, we think she'll do quite well.
It'll be interesting to see.
I worry about that, but I think she's got some options.
She's done.
Didn't she win or lose by 6 one time in one of her races? It's been close,
yeah.
So I want to ask a couple questions before we move on. One thing is people voted for Prop 4. So Greg, my question is, are people going to get sick of voting for these propositions if they feel like they vote and then the legislature unvotes? Because it seems like everything's been untied every time in recent memory.
There are some issues, and it is problematic when you vote, when there's a referendum on statute and it passes. A lot of that does require changes because if you just parachute it in the coordinating clause, there's some even technical issues with how that works. This issue, though, specifically, if you look at how it passed, it surprisingly, even to me surprisingly, barely passed. It was not an overwhelming, for the narrative being, let's be fair, Ronald Reagan decided that he wanted to do this in California, let's be fair and do it this way. You would have thought that would have received a large majority throughout the state, but it didn't, because I think people were worried that, well, that's kind of why we elect lawmakers. But for whatever reason, if you looked region by region or district by district, it did not pass. It passed largely on the weight of the voters in Salt Lake County.
Is that how statewide elections work?
It does.
It only holds like what the
distribution
is.
But interesting to the topic of redistricting, if you look at the constituencies and how they voted and how they would expect their lawmaker to vote, it did not have the majority of the people they represent saying, we want this redistricting committee.
Is that how lawmaking works?
To have a larger say.
So you only represented the precincts that you performed well in. You came Speaker of the House Hughes. And Speaker of the House Hughes would look under my precinct and say, Mara, unfortunately, your area didn't perform well enough for me to really care about your problems.
I'm saying that there are many reasons why referendums have legislative action that happen afterwards. I'm giving you the reason why specifically this one.
Because you guys
felt
didn't
they had
feel
a stronger
like
say.
The right kind of people voted in favor
most
of it, even though the majority
didn't approve
won.
It by region. They didn't approve
most
it.
Most people
by
in the state passed the law. I'll just go
it's
over.
Like
I'm going to
use
like
when
my
Denver
slow voice.
Passes
with you.
A state, like a Colorado statewide initiative passes on the backs of the most liberal people in Denver. We don't do it that way when we qualify something for the ballot, because you have to have so many signatures and so much
each area,
from
which is
areas.
Different than how we do governor and statewide offices. And
I
governor
know,
and statewide offices could just be elected
Look,
by anybody.
Of, don't, I'm just
you
a messenger.
You are not a source.
I'm just a messenger.
You are a manipulator.
Don't up as the messenger.
So
I'm
first,
just
I'm going to be that person that points out they're not referendums, they're initiatives. Yeah, I'm going to be that
okay,
person.
Okay, be that
and
person.
And then I'm going to say this argument is one of the stupidest ones I've heard from Republicans in a long time, in which they're like the wrong kind of people voted
in the
majority.
They're not on the wrong side of their constituents.
The majority.
They're not on the wrong side of their
constituents. The majority of Utahns wanted this independent commission to be listened to.
The majority
in
Salt Lake City.
And the majority in the House decided that the wrong kind of people voted for it.
The majority in Salt Lake City wanted it. The constituents from the other districts,
no,
they
Greg,
were not asking them to do it.
As the Republicans have showed us over and over again, Democrats can't win statewide.
I'm like a carrier pigeon in this conversation. I'm just delivering the information. I am not expressing an opinion. I'm just giving. I'm laying out the facts.
I think you're doing subliminal messaging right now.
Laying out the
facts.
All right. Well, one thing I do think was interesting as we wrap up this conversation is the town hall, or whatever you call it, when the governor went live on Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and everywhere else. I felt like he was very honest about the process, his fact that he was going to veto, and I thought it was interesting that he just kind of was, I am what I am, I'm a Republican, this is who you elected, and here we go.
So it pains me for some reason to criticize him. I kind of sort of like Spencer Cox, but here's what What offended me so
You said
much.
It like you think he's a Democrat. That's how you said it just now.
I think a lot of Democrats were hoping he was more Democrat. I think they felt like maybe they were, so he had one left arm that was Democrat.
Here's what really just like got me in that. His answer back, he said, and just be specific, at this moment in time, straight to camera, he's saying to those of you who are frustrated, I know there's a lot of people out there frustrated. And he has me, right? I'm listening.
You're listening.
To
you're like, I'm here.
So I'm listening, and he says, you know what you need to do? You need to vote for better people. Okay, the irony of you telling me after gerrymandering and having my vote taken away.
Earlier in this program, you called for that kind of
blunt information. That's not honesty. You said, I argue that you played the table in a way that I can't win. And you're like, you should get a better dealer. I'm like, what? I don't get to pick the dealer.
You did not hear yourself earlier in this podcast because you said, why don't you just, instead of saying it's deliberative and everything, just say we make the rules, you don't. That's
right.
What I just told you.
No, he didn't. He said you should elect better people. And the whole premise of the argument is you're not allowing me the means to elect better people. And so you telling me it's my fault and I should elect better people is sort of egregious to those who are frustrated. So I would support the Speaker of the House saying, you know what, I hear you, I'm sorry, but I'm in charge, you're not. But what the governor said to me is, hey, listen, you guys should just elect better people. And I'm like, my argument is you're not allowing me to elect better people.
Yeah, I don't understand anything.
The one thing I think was interesting, though, that he said is that people walked out after the congressional maps, and nobody likes to vote in municipal elections. Nobody wants to vote for the legislator. Like, people want to vote for the big ticket items,
right,
the sexy stuff. They want to vote for president or the congressional or the Senate. And what people, I think, should learn and never learn is that showing up for those little races, your legislators, and the smaller offices, that's eventually what kind of jiggers things and moves things inside of your state and changes it. So,
Amen. So
to that, people, stick around for another 4 hours of meetings, or in this session, another 20 minutes.
Amen.
I don't know.
Every group of young people that I would give a tour of the Capitol when I was there for 16 years, I would tell these young people, because they were very disinterested, some adult had planned a tour of the Capitol. They were there against their will. I could read it in their eyes.
Oh, but it's
but
so pretty,
say,
even if you don't like the politics.
I wasn't catching that. That's not the vibe I was catching. But I would say to them, and this is where I'd say, you might not care about politics, but it's an ancient saying, but politics cares about you, okay? And I tell them, there's a lot of people up here that hope you never care because they love making the rules and they want you to follow their rules. So they hope that you never care about politics. And I say that as a challenge because I want them to realize that they will live by the rules of those that do pay attention, so that I'm almost taunting them to say, look, you need to pay attention to this because people are banking that you won't, so they can go make the rules. And so, to your point, Heidi, every one of these elections count, and whether it's the high profile or not, if you look at how these elections impact our lives, local control for municipality, county, and state legislature, they all truly do. So if you don't care, there's people that are very grateful that apathy's there, that you don't care, because they want to make the rules and they don't want you to interfere with that process. So.
It is true. And Utah has an apathy problem, which I hope we're digging out of, but definitely something to think about.
Getting rid of that. I think everybody's getting a little more salty.
Thanks, Twitter, for helping us all out on that.
Yeah, really.
Well, we've talked almost our whole podcast on redistricting, so I want to move on to the legislature quickly passed a bill allowing exemptions to Biden's vaccine mandate. And they're basically the same exemptions you would get at Utah schools if you wanted to sign something so your kids weren't vaccinated, so it was religious, medical, or personal reasons. My question here, Greg, we'll start with you on this one. No, Mara, your turn.
Okay.
So, Mara, when the legislature passes something like this, will it have, I guess, the foothold it needs to preempt a federal mandate that's coming from OSHA? Because there's always the question of federalism and who's in charge and which bill is on top of the other bill and who's really in charge. Will it work?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're sorting through the legal standing of it, but it has questionable legal standing, and it's smartly, or maybe arguably poorly, almost addresses different sections of the code. I mean, that's one thing that's challenging, is sort of what are you responding to? OSHA's directive is more clear and harder for a state to intervene with, but hey, they went really broad, and they went, and they did a smart thing in which, as you suggested, they mirrored thing they had done before, and that was a really smart thing to do. And so from that perspective, it's true. I think really what they were doing, though, is sending a message and saying, hey, we're going to fight for this on behalf of those who didn't fight for it.
You feel like this is more of a message bill, and they'll let the lawsuits that were filed by the 23 states
be
the lawsuit.
Yeah, it'll give courage to some local businesses, perhaps, but there is one component of it that I haven't heard anybody discuss, and so I'm just going to bring it up because I don't know the answer to it. The interesting part of the religious exemption for COVID is that most of the major religions that we follow in Utah have actually come out in favor. And most of the time, where religions haven't opined upon a medical thing,
it is
right?
Interesting because the Catholic Church and LDS Church and other states have said we won't sign here.
Yeah, and the LDS Church has been the most aggressive about saying, please do this, please do this, please do this. And so this is all philosophical. I don't even know, but I thought, oh, it's so interesting. And no one's going to fact check you at that moment. But it's so interesting that you might cite a religious exemption when your religion has essentially stated a position that's much more in favor of the get the shot.
You haven't heard the answer, so let me give it to you.
Oh, great. Thank you for being
here. This is probably more...
I'm kind of like a cafeteria Catholic, though, but not a Catholic. And so I just pick and choose what I want from my religion. So how do you know what my religion really is?
The definition is your moral objection. Because they want to be very sensitive that people not be necessarily required to affiliate with a formal faith, because maybe they don't. They didn't want that exemption to be unavailable to them. So it's more of a moral objection.
I think
objection.
It doesn't say that. It says something broader than that. But,
yeah, but but that's the key. It's broader. So if you have a faith that comes out with a position and you are a member of that faith, you can still exercise a religious exemption if it's based on your moral beliefs or whatever their definition is. But it is on
purpose.
There's
a clue of religiosity.
I know that. Yeah, so Mara wants you to show your religious card at the
Mara
table
wants to, question,
to exercise a religious exemption. And
Mara wants
to
question
that.
The conservatives.
We're like the Democrats.
For the first time, the conservatives are at odds with the Mormon church. Let's just be, it's just interesting. The liberal Mormons have often had to grapple with that position in a public position.
Yeah.
And this is philosophical. It's not legal.
Yeah.
And you know, as Catholic,
you want everyone to show their card. Are they a member of good faith?
We're not on some radio show that does that, Greg.
No, you turned into the Bible lady. Or what was that lady in the 80s that Saturday Night Live?
I think it was the Bible.
I think so. Okay.
So, but it's just an interesting thing at this point where we haven't seen in the public domain such a clear, on the same single subject.
Church lady.
Sorry to interrupt you, but it was Dana Carvey.
Okay.
So we haven't seen such a clear, again, nobody's checking. I'm not asking people to check.
Yeah.
But we've had a very specific directive from both churches now and the state. On one vaccine.
Church and state mating on
one
issue. It is interesting.
Is all in. But no,
it's because churches want the ability to meet, I think. I think that's a big push from, I look at it, I think churches, they can't be who they are unless you could publicly meet together.
There is more of a legal crush or the fear or fear. Feel or
and you can't get tithing from people when they're sitting at home. Well, you can.
So can I say that these exemptions that the state passed were incredibly important, because I do think you have to signal to, because you're seeing this, I would argue, you're seeing an encroachment from the executive branch federally that you've not seen before. And the problem, and we've been living through this problem, it's been a creep,
you
and now it's a sprint.
You didn't think the Patriot Act was an encroachment?
No. In hindsight, I think it's an absolutely horrific one.
You don't think America has taken these steps before?
No, I think
none of this is new.
I'm saying that it was a creep towards this. It's a sprint now. I think Obama didn't work with Congress a lot. I heard Harry Reid, when he was the majority leader in the Senate, complain that the Obama administration did not work well with Congress. So you've seen this from the executive branch.
You know it's President Biden.
I know,
right?
But I'm saying that these executive branch, I wouldn't, and I'm not, by the way, I'm being very fair here. I'm not saying it's just Democrat administrations. I'm saying Republican and Democrat administrations alike, if they can't get Congress to work with them or do what they want, they find these workarounds on the executive side. The reason why state lawmakers are not better leaders per se than those in Congress, it's just that you have to balance a budget because you can't print money in a state. So there's like a necessity to having to get legislative work accomplished and done. They have too many workarounds in our Congress, and there's too many workarounds with the executive branch and the legislative branch federally. And so when you now empower OSHA to start mandating businesses the way that the Biden administration would do, that would be a legislative role if it were to ever happen, and it would be something that would need to be rolled out in legislation. He just wants to do it. So he finds a way to do it.
Didn't our legislature just pass a mandate? We just mandated.
No way. We're protecting medical freedom and medical privacy.
No, you mandated. They made a non-exemptable law.
Yeah, that people have privacy.
Oh, so wait
a minute.
I'm sorry.
No.
It's still the same mechanism, Greg.
No, it isn't.
Greg,
it's not mandating against mandates. I've heard this argument before. It's not. It's actually preserving people's personal right towards their medical privacy and liberty that they don't have. They can't be compelled to do these things.
Liberty
and freedom. I know these are foreign words
to
you.
No, I just know that you're malarkey a little bit when you're protecting that liberty.
Medical freedom and privacy are absolutely essential. They always have been. They've only been debatable as of late.
You and I,
an employer saying you have to show
privacy, but you're talking about
an employer saying you have to show me a medical procedure having been done to keep
private sector business.
Private entities cannot violate HIPAA.
Right.
I should not have
to
produce
medical
procedures. I shouldn't have
to
do it. So I should be able to exempt from that effort or that action, and that's what the legislature protected.
So mandates
God
are fine if they're on your ideological
terms. That's not a mandate.
You
keep calling it a mandate. It's not. It's preserving medical privacy and freedom.
Is it a mandate or is it just the message? I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
I'll tell you this. It's a mandate that you get to continue your medical privacy and freedom that we've enjoyed up until now. That's true. But to that degree, if you want to insert the word mandate, you know, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness
are mandated.
So, Greg,
here's my question. If someone's at home right now, they have a reason, whether it's medical or philosophical, they don't want to get vaccinated. They know they have to go to work on January 4th after the holidays. Can they safely say after the legislature passed this, I can go to work and be fine?
Yep.
Or do they have to worry about finding another
job?
They
are fine. There is a stay currently on. Now, I'll tell you, the only part that the legislature pulled back on are the federal contracts. If your employer receives Medicaid, Medicare money, if it's a federal contract, there is more of a connection between the federal decisions. They want you, they're the people that they send their federal money to, whatever businesses those may be. There is a stronger connection with federal mandates with those that are.
If you work for the
federal
government,
Yeah, or not even work for them. If you're a contractor with the federal government, you see that might be the case. But that's the one that's a little sticky. We'd like the courts to sort out. But if it's not that relationship, the state of Utah has given you the ability to exempt out, which I applaud them for.
And there are a lot of people with federal contracts. We were talking to some of the people who just, dig sand off the edge of the mountain, and they have federal contracts, I guess, for roads or whatever else they're doing. So I think there's a lot more contractors out there than you realize.
This is, it's going to keep evolving, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to keep talking about this.
Well, there's a stay, and there's going to be a hearing. I think that hearing was this week or happened. I don't know when, but this isn't being unnoticed, and the courts are going to have to sift through this or sort through it, and we'll see what they say.
All right, you're up first on this one, Greg Hughes. Dixie State passed with the skin of somebody's hairy chin. It seems to me that early in the day we were hearing when the vote passed that the Senate wasn't going to have enough votes. Then they did, and it seems like keeping the campus called Dixie Campus for 20 years is what won over the votes. The actual university name, though, is changing to Utah Polytech. So kids can now have Utah Polytech on their resume, on their jerseys, and then if you just want to redneck it, you can say you're going to the Dixie Campus.
I think,
what's
I don't
happening
know the
here?
Poly part. I think it's just Utah Tech now.
But Utah Tech. Oh, excuse me. I forget that.
When you say by a slim margin, there's 29 state senators.
True, and it was a 17-12 vote,
23 of them are Republican. 12 Republican senators voted against changing the name. 11 Republican senators joined the Democrats to have the 17 votes to pass it. So you don't see a lot of times where, and this is where the Senate president was accurate in his discussion earlier in the day, I don't know where the votes are, because you don't see a minority of a Republican Senate caucus teaming up with the Democrats to pass a respective bill, which is what happened in this case. The sad part is the narrative of Dixie and the glass ceiling above these students' heads that they can't get a job anywhere is just patently false. They have a high placement rate of graduates. That school has seen incredible growth in student population. They grew in the COVID year when USU saw student enrollment decline. It is just not the case. What happened is in 2020, people began to think words like Dixie and other words were pejoratives, and that we had to erase or cancel these historic words because of fear of backlash. And wokeism, and so they bought into it. And I cannot handle hearing selective logic where they say this has nothing to do with cancel culture or being woke, but you know, Dixie used to be racist. And then they go on this whole narrative about the racist meaning of the word Dixie, which is in its definition the cancel culture you're buying into. The Dixie heritage of that state had nothing to do with racism. They were people from the South that were pioneers. They grew cotton down there. It was Utah's Dixie. And the saddest part is you get rid of that name and that university, you still have a high school called Dixie High School. And if the idea is that they can't get jobs with a degree from Dixie, what about the kids that want to go to school out of state with their high school diploma from Dixie? What about the technical school, the trade school that's Dixie Tech? Is that going to have a chilling effect? What about the power company, for heaven's sake, is called Dixie Power? If you are offended by the word Dixie, you better blindfold yourself anytime you're off that campus, because that word is literally everywhere because it's part of their culture. And lastly, I'll just say this. The reason the recoil from the residents of Washington County has been so apparent and so emotional is that the idea that Dixie is racist, if they embrace Utah's Dixie, which again is everywhere, including on the mountainside, they aren't racist, and they are going to argue, I am not racist, and the word Dixie isn't racist because I feel a connection to Utah's Dixie, and I'm not going to let you demean that and call it racist. And so they have not had a branding problem, they've not had an enrollment problem, they have a high placement of students into careers. This is just this parachuted in 2020, in a time where that we were trying to, you saw statues being torn down and people trying to erase anything that they thought could be racist. And I think that this community, it's sad that they were on the wrong side of a political movement of our day.
In deference to sort of the emotion that Greg is expressing well to this issue, I am going to resist the urge to point-by-point refute, because that's, I think, what's been happening for the last several months. And I think what Greg expressed well is the emotion around it. And
there is a lot of emotion, yeah.
And how people feel blamed.
Well,
and how
they must be called a racist when they don't feel like they are. Sorry.
Nobody does. And that's the hard part about these discussions, is what you hear and what you know. I mean, I do think it's important from my point of view to point out that the question about the Confederate flag and rebel and Dixie has come up before 2020. And
they self-corrected, they got rid of it long ago.
Well, the pronoun, I'm not sure. But like, so I think it's unfair to say, gosh, we've never had the discussion of what these symbols in America mean before what Greg would call and loves to call the woke culture. So I think that's an unfair timeline. But I think what Greg expressed well is the emotion around it. And I think the emotion around it is what made this issue. I mean, we essentially had different conversations, be it the Board of Education or be it the legislature. We've had these decisions made four different times in the last several months on this issue. Again, showing all the constituencies, showing all the passion. I think it's really important that we can move on. I don't say that lightly of those who had their name changed, but I do think it's important, and certainly from my point of view, it modernizes and it just takes care of liabilities. I left out of the discussion, it makes it sound like we birthed this name, you know, when Brigham came across, and this institution has had 8 name changes, and we've lived through a lot of name changes in other institutions, and we've changed all the other small colleges. So that is to say, if we can sort of move forward and regain those symbols of pride. But I think instead of refuting, I'm just going to acknowledge that the energy that you brought to the discussion, Greg, is a lot of why this has been so hard, is that people are feeling very personally attacked by this. I think it will be a good thing. I think at the end of the day, it will provide more opportunities. Why keep a name where anyone may have a negative point of view, intended or unintended?
But I'll say this too. I think unfair to the students, if and I heard this narrative, getting away from the cancel culture or that Dixie's racist, so we got to cancel that and forget about it. If you just talk about rebranding and wanting people to know you're from Utah and not particularly the South, or if you want people to know what your school mission is, just because they put the word Tech in that name, okay, does not put them on par with Virginia Tech, Georgia Tech, Texas Tech. If you look at the size of those schools and the programs they offer, if you want for a parent whose child or even a student that wants to go to a school that would be the closest to a Virginia Tech or a Georgia Tech, it would be the University of Utah or Utah State University, these research institutions.
Yeah.
It would not be Dixie State University, because while they would like to be a stronger tech type school, they aren't even close yet. And so I think that I keep hearing that, well, we're rebranding because we're like Virginia Tech. They have an over $1 billion a year budget, and the programs they offer, they're not even remotely close. So, you know, mission creep is kind of one of the it's part and parcel with higher ed. Everybody wants to be bigger and something that they're not right now. They want to be a bigger school and they want to call themselves something bigger than they are. I don't know that that name does accurately reflect that 12,000 student school. And I think that they could have done more to show that those programs or offer more of those programs before they would start calling themselves Utah Tech and then saying their own name in the same breath with some of these tech schools like Virginia Tech.
A long runway for success, Greg. I mean, you just like...
The legislature in me is saying there's a lot of fiscal notes they're going to be asking for to get those kinds of programs.
There's some room for growth. And the good news is if you're mad and you graduated from Dixie, you can still call it Dixie. If you hated that was the name, you can change it on your thing. I still call the Delta Center, which is not the Delta Center, the Delta Center. You know, you just stick with whatever you self-identify with. I know. There was Vivint. It's Vivint, and then there was
Energy Solutions.
Those were just two big names. For some reason, Delta Center was just like...
But you know, do y'all remember what Utah Valley University was first?
It was a community college first, right?
Remember how long it was to change? I mean, they changed their name.
Utah Valley never got out of it. They never took the Utah Valley out.
We're talking about remembering whether it's Vivint or Delta.
Here's the other thing I reject.
Like, well, adjust.
This whole, you know, we have to have Utah. I find Utah anything to be kind of generic, but... Weber State University, outside of Utah, who in the world knows where Weber State is?
Nobody.
I mean, even, this isn't a state institution of higher learning, but Brigham Young, that doesn't have the name Utah in it. Baylor doesn't have the name of Texas.
We knew who the Bears are, yeah.
But did you know where, I mean, Rutgers? I mean, some of these names of these schools, I mean, to say that you have to have the state that it's from in the name or else it's a problem, I don't buy into that narrative necessarily either.
Yeah, it is true. They really should have just taken the Southern Utah University name before someone else took it, and they screwed up.
And they just upped it.
I got to tell you this. The greatest comment on the Senate floor about this debate was the Senator Hinkins. He is my hero. He got up and said, Dixie, I thought it was a party school, and they named it after the red cups everybody was drinking at the parties at that school. Beautiful comment. I love that.
That is kind of funny, because growing up, that's sort of what my apologies to anyone who graduated from Dixie, but... That was my thought growing up, too. So, anyhow, I didn't connect it to the party cups. I like that idea. Before we leave, have any of you guys listened to Abby Huntsman's new podcast by any chance?
I didn't.
It's interesting. So, you'll have to listen to it. We'll have to get it back and talk about it later. But she sat down and interviewed her dad, which I'm guessing wasn't a very hard get, because when your dad says nobody, you're screwed. But I thought it was interesting because we haven't heard a ton from him since he lost the election. And I thought that he still sounded not very pleased. He called the election ridiculous. I think that
I would agree.
Greg would agree on that.
I thought it was ridiculous. I didn't win. Of course I think it's ridiculous.
And I thought it was interesting that he was still a politician saying that he had no plans of running, but the door is certainly open because you never know what happens in life.
I'll say that.
So,
you know what?
What do you foresee him running as?
I'm not ruling anything out.
Yeah.
The door is open.
He's young and his name ID is... In Utah, he's always got to go at running if he wants it.
It's true. And I think the last two presidential elections have proved to us that you can be as old as you want if you want to run. Thanks, Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Yeah.
I like John Huntsman Jr. I appreciate his family. I think they've done incredible things for this state that most people will never even know the degree of which they've just selfishly, I think, have given to this state. So I think they're leaders in our state, and I quite like John. I didn't like he ran against me. That was a bummer.
I know that was rude, right?
Yeah, I was really sad about that part.
Good news is, under your redistricting philosophy, you are the governor of 11 counties.
It is true.
Thank you for noticing.
Yeah,
and you know what?
Congratulations.
I'm glad you pointed that out, because I do think of it that way. I think of Liberty Land. Utah has a Liberty Land. It's clearly the counties that voted for.
Okay, if I'm thoughtful enough for Christmas, I'm going to print you out a t-shirt with your 11 counties on it. It says governor. I think it's a good idea.
Thank you.
And you can name anything you want. It doesn't even have to have
I'm going with Liberty Land right now. That's what I'm going with. So.
All right.
It's like Disneyland, except for everyone's happy when they stand in line.
Great to be with you, Governor.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us and carving some time out of your very important day. We'll see you next week.